Thank you. Well, I'm Julie Berglund, and first of all, thank you so much for inviting me to do this. It's an honor and a blessing, and I just pray that I will glorify God and in all my prayers, that when I ask the Lord, you know, to speak through me, the objective is to glorify God and to reach out to anybody who might think that they're different and to know that they're not alone. So I was saved by grace about 19 and a half years ago in February of 1997 when I was pregnant with my second child. And the longer that I grow and walk with Christ, then even my own testimony looks different to me as I look back. And one of the things that I feel like the Lord has really ministered to me in my walk with Him is generational covenant, as that question has plagued me, as that it does so many, why me? And that question arises from several things, including that I'm the first one in my family that I know of to be a Christian. My mother was not a Christian. My father was not a Christian. Neither one of either their parents were Christians, nor either of their parents, any of them, that I'm aware of. My mother's mother had some, a bit of background in Mormonism is the rumor, but even she was excommunicated from them. So I come from a long background of unbelievers who were messed up, and there was a lot of brokenness. I was born into a family that looked very much like at the time that I was born, a thriving middle class, even middle upper class American dream family. Certainly that's what I thought. And then as I got older and understood more, I realized that I was born into a terrible amount of brokenness. My mother and my father were both on their third marriages. And my mother had children from one of her previous marriages. So that I have three half-sisters. And then my mother and my father had my brother first and then me. As I later found out, they got married because she was pregnant with my brother. And it wasn't necessarily what she wanted to do, but felt that that was what was necessary. And so some of my very earliest memories, so my parents were living in San Clemente, California at the time, and shortly there, when I was about three, I think we moved to Mandeville Canyon, which is a rather exclusive neighborhood where, you know, when we had avocado stands, we sold avocados instead of lemonade. Movie stars came and bought our avocados and things like that. So, and we lived there until I was seven. And during that time, that was the period of time where I thought we were, you know, maybe everybody in that period of their life figures out what they believe normal is. And so we were totally normal. But even from the outside, we looked like a totally normal family. So I remember at a very young age just playing in the dirt, and there was a drainage ditch out front. When we first moved there was a creek that flowed right next to the road that you had to get over to get into all of the homes, and then I remember when the construction crew came and they put in a drainage ditch and drainage pipe and covered it all over. And so there was a lot of construction going on at that time, and I'd go out there and play a lot, and there was lots of worms and bugs, and it was lots of fun. And I remember looking at these, like ants, I think it was at the time, a whole bunch of ants and playing with them and thinking, is there a God that looks over us like I'm looking over these ants, then they're completely unaware of me. Are we like that? There's somebody there that we're completely unaware of looking over us. Because there had been not any teaching about God in my family, but there had been questions recently because my mother died. She became very, very ill very suddenly. She had a brain tumor, and by the time we even realized she was really sick, was within a couple weeks, she was in a coma, was in the hospital for about 9 months, and died. So I remember that time of her being sick. I don't remember very much time with her before that. And so the questions about God kind of came up and bubbled up in our lives, but there was no answers. And I know I certainly had questions. I remember asking, I think one of my sisters, God, what God, who's God? And I think she said something to the effect of, well, God is all around us. He's everywhere all the time, which was a very obviously kind of an ambiguous answer for somebody 3 years old who just lost her mom, and or four. So I also remember after that, I was having to go to preschool, having a tremendous amount of anxiety because my mother just died, and so I remember being dropped off, excuse me, every morning and just crying uncontrollably that I was being left. And yet, after a while, by the end of the day, I seemed to be settled in pretty well. And at one of these preschools, there was art at the end of the day. And I remember, as a result of this conversation about God, drawing the sky all around the stick girls, how kids do, and thinking, that's God. God's like that. He's everywhere, all around us, all the time. You know, no idea. These are the answers I'm getting when I'm asking. So, and yet somehow those ideas did, you know, they were there because I remember them to this day. I remember the question, you know, that those were the answers to that question. We moved a lot. This whole American dream crumbled very quickly after my mother died. My dad's business partner also died, and his dad died all within 3 years, and his world really crumbled. He was an only child and was not well raised by people who were not Christian. He had a very harsh upbringing, and he was very harsh. And so he wanted, I'm sure, that all-American dream, but he had no idea what it was to parent, or certainly what that meant without a wife to do that for him. And so, you know, he was lost. And financially, we were just kind of tumbling down a little further as the years went by. So we were moving to a lesser and lesser neighborhood as we went. And in 1976, we lived in an apartment in Torrance. And my dad was had a very good intellect. His heart was messed up, but he had a pretty decent intellect. And one of the things, he was very much into finance and politics, and recognized that the heart of LA was not a really safe place to be, and wanted to get us out of there. So he built our VW bus into a camper and put us in it and just went north. And we lived in that for about 9 months, and we found a place to rent. What it was a house that was unfinished that he agreed with the owner to do work on the house for rent. So we went there. We didn't really know them, but, you know, he launched into this deal, and this house was very unfinished. There were, I think, some doors and windows were not on it, and it was just a very basic structure. So we had been there for 2 or 3 weeks, and he needed to go back to California and get some of our stuff that he'd put in storage. And so he left me there. And I think ostensibly with the oversight of some of these, a couple of these families that were there. So I was 11. And it took him longer to do that than expected, which was his MO. It always took him longer to do anything. So, but he did eventually come back, and then he said he had to go again. And so they went. He took my brother with him and left me there while he was gone much too long. And the people decided, and I think it was a couple of months, and they decided that I had been abandoned. And they took me to the police, and they and I adamantly tried to convince them, "You don't understand. I've not been abandoned. He's coming back." And they said, "Yeah, okay." And they took me to a foster home. It actually, that was not the first little episode of that. While we were still living in the bus, he had dropped me off to do laundry in Olympia on our way north, and didn't come back. And that was my actually second time in my recollection that I knew that I was being followed by a predator. While I was there, I went walking, looking for the place that he had taken the bus to a gas station where they had a lift so he could work on it. And he, I went looking for that place, and I knew that I was being followed by a man. And so I just got back to the laundromat, and I told the lady that worked there that that was happening. And she said, "Well, you just stay there." And I did. And I stayed there well after closing until she finally called the police. And they took me actually to juvenile detention, I guess, because they didn't know what to do with me, and they stripped me down and put me in a concrete room. So then I went to a foster home that morning. Eventually, he found me, and we went on again. And so this time up there in Centralia was actually the second time, a second episode of being placed in a foster home for being left. And he found me. After, it was, I think about a week, he got back and he found me, and they released me to him again. And so, obviously, after that, we going back to live at that place was not an option anymore. And honestly, it gets a bit hazy. There were so many different places and so many different little events of being separated from my dad and my brother that it gets a little hazy, whatever. But there was eventually a time when we ended up in Concrete. This is on the coast of Washington, on the west coast, and I was actually going to school there again. I had been enrolled in school. I think it was 7th grade, and his mother became very ill. She lived in Indianapolis, and so he said he needed to go back there and, see what he could do to get things settled, take care of things, find out what needed to be done, and so left both my brother and I there in a rented cabin, and with the somewhat oversight of the people who owned the cabins. And in the end, we actually really kind of ended up moving in with them because they were good folks. And they said, "You're too young to just be on your own out here. So just come here and we'll feed you." So they did that. And again, it ended up being way too long. And I remember hearing her have phone conversations with him saying, "You need to come back and get your kids." And eventually he did. And we flew out to Indiana, and then there was a, I want to back up a little bit there, when we were still in California, and I was in middle school, there was, I walked back and forth to school, and there was a couple handing out cards saying they were going to have a party, and I remember taking the card home And my youngest half-sister still lived with us at that point. And she said, oh, I remember her saying something about, oh, it's a Jesus party. And I asked if I could go. And my dad said, sure, yeah, you can go. So they invited all the kids that, you know, were willing to come, were able to come into their home. And they did flannel board, and they told us the gospel. And that was the first time I'd ever really heard the gospel. And I was probably maybe fifth grade. And and from that point, you know, even then, even before we headed north, we were latchkey kids. We were alone most all the time. So we found lots of mischief to be in together, especially. Jumping back ahead, we're there in Indianapolis, and was a time in America when everything was the huge integration push was on. I remember thinking, well, if I could just, I'd had a lot of trouble in school. By this time, you know, had very low self-esteem, wore a sign that said kick me, and everywhere I went, they did. And I was bullied and picked on a lot, and always was a huge breath of relief to just not be in school. It was, to me, like going, and I remembered that, you know, people would say, well, Julie's so smart, if she would just work up to her potential. And they would have these conversations about me in my hearing, and I thought, you know, you don't realize that I'm having to just fight for survival every day. And so it was a huge relief to me to not be in school. So when we got there to Indianapolis, we were looking at what school I was going to be enrolled in, and there was this very small local school that I could walk to, and it just seemed so, there was some sort of comfort or safety in it. I thought, I like the look of this. This is, and I didn't get to go there. I had to be bused for an hour across town and go to a school that was predominantly black. It was a huge school with the new open concept, and it was so it was worse than ever. The school had factions that were just pitted against each other, and it was a mess. And school was still not my focus, to say the least. So problems began to arise. I remember, just as an example, the bullying just really increased. And I really, I got along with the black kids just fine. It was often I just had one really good girlfriend. So my girlfriend was black. And the white kids didn't like that. So it was really the white kids from my neighborhood that ended up really bullying me hard. And they were, of course, the ones that I had to ride the bus with and had to spend so much time just getting to and fro. And so it got pretty hazardous for me to go out and catch the bus. And being that, and they did drugs and they smoked and all of this stuff, you know. And so I thought, well, if I just let, you know, when they want to know, you know, do you get high? I don't want to say no, because that'll, you know, surely get me in the worst boat. So I would give some ambiguous answer, and they really took that as being very stuck up. So I remember one time I thought, well, I'm going to solve this because I'll just smoke a cigarette with them. They're standing at the bus stop, and I had gone home, and I had complained to my dad. I said, you know, this is bad. I don't know what to do. They're getting around, and they're getting me in a circle, and they're pushing me around, and they're spitting on me, and I don't know what to do. And I'm not really getting any help. So anyway, I take matters into my own hands and decide I'll smoke a cigarette with them, and then they'll see how cool I really am. So of course it didn't work, and but I get them to light this cigarette, and this happens to be the day I look up and I'm walking away from them, and there's my dad. So he's watching from the corner. So I got in trouble for smoking the cigarette. So needless to say, I still didn't get any help with dealing with the war zone. And neither did it work. I didn't gain, obviously, any respect from these kids over doing that. So it was a mess, and it was a really difficult thing to just get through. And was really relieved when I think it might have been the following year that my dad said, okay, we'll homeschool you. Well, we never made it to that because he met a girl who was, so at this point, he's about 50, maybe 52 or something, and I'm just barely 12 probably. And he met a girl who was about 10 years older than me, and he just really liked her. Well, actually, I really think he thought he was in love with her. He decided it would be a good thing for me to go live with her for however long. We'd just figure that out as we went. And she had a little girl who was 10 years younger than me. So her parents lived in Indianapolis, but she was going to go out on her own and do something. So she and myself and her daughter moved to Boston. And she worked, and she supported us, and I watched Kaya, her little girl, while she did that, which was not ideal. Just in the light of the fact that I'd had very poor parenting and certainly didn't know what I was doing taking care of this little girl. But I learned a lot of things from her. I learned a lot of things that were not good. You know, I loved her dearly. I worshiped the ground she walked on. And she had some very liberal views. And we did, in fact, get very involved in studying with a community of people, macrobiotics, which is really an Eastern religion. And it centers a lot around diet as well. But it's essentially, it's Eastern mysticism. And we were very much involved in that. And I believed anything that she handed me. I just loved her that much. She taught me all kinds of things, that really doing drugs is fine. It wasn't as though we weren't the, you know, we weren't in the corner shooting up drugs or anything like that, but smoking pot, it's fine, it's no big deal. Same-sex relationships are fine, that's fine. You know, just complete liberal outlook on the world. And I just took that on and owned that as my own, as well as the Eastern religion. And then we moved to Florida. Her parents had a retirement house. Her parents were pretty wealthy, and they had a home in Indianapolis, but they also had a home in Boca Raton, Florida. And we just packed up and moved down there and stayed in that house, which was a very comfortable way to live. But in order to make the money that she needed to support us now down there, she resorted to some things that, you know, I think that this had come out of her past, and she resorted to this again, which was she got a job as an exotic dancer. And of course, in my mind, that's fine too, because she's doing that, right? So, this is over, I lived with her for at least a year. I think it was going on more than a year at this point. And I'm starting to have some bad behaviors. There came a point there where I babysat for some other people, and I stole from them. And so that came to light. I think I actually did some things to make it intentionally come to light, because I didn't know how to deal with it. And her solution was to send me back to my dad at that point. And so I went back there. And then at that point, as little able as my dad and I were able to relate to each other when I left, at this point then, it was just, we were so, his expectation of what I should be and my expectation of what I should be or what he should be was so far apart, we couldn't, it was kind of untenable for us to even live together. He was very harsh. He was an abusive dad. And so one day he hit me and I just left. And I mean, that happened a lot of times. So, you know, I'd left a lot of times and come back. And but one time there was the last time. And in fact, I remember that that particular day, he was hitting me and my brother stepped in. And he was still really skinny, and he was, I think, maybe 15, and I remember him just shaking life like a leaf, but it really left an impression how he was willing to step in and try to protect me. And so my brother and I were very close, even to that, up to that time, and I always stayed in touch with him, and we communicated quite a lot. And so I left again. And then it was really touch and go for a while as far as I did go back to Florida for a little while and stayed with Nedra for a little while again, came back to Indiana, just trying to make my way any way I could and find any help I could in doing that. I did spend time on the streets. Knew what it was to be very hungry. And I'd slept under bridges. I finally got myself a job. I got a fake ID, and I did look much older than my years. So at, you know, about 14, I got a bartender's license. And I worked just making pizza and serving beer. Had a false name. And that went on for... I worked there about 6 months. I was still in touch with my brother, always in touch with my brother. Well, a couple suspicious things happened. He called there one time and asked for Julie. My false name was Jamie, and so the person answering the phone was the boss. And I said, oh, and I took the call. I mean, so just a few things happened where he got suspicious that something wasn't all right. And during this time, I lived in a a place that need. I lived in a fixer upper, in exchange for rent, and it didn't have any electricity, among other things. I met the person that owned it hitchhiking, and so, you know, I needed a place to live, and I said, yeah, sure, okay, you provide the stuff, I'll paint, I'll do stuff, you know, but. It needed work far beyond my capability. So I just, it was also on a pretty seedy side of town, so getting from work to there at night after closing was always pretty dicey. I didn't drive or have a license, and I hitchhiked everywhere I went. My brother, you know, was pretty worried. He came out and he saw how I was living, and he was very concerned. And anyway, convinced me that I should let my dad come and visit me. So I did agree to that, and he came to the place where I worked, and it was either after hours or after my shift. Sat down in a booth and ate with him, and he told me that I should really come home. And I said, no, that's not happening. And I wanted to convince him that he should just emancipate me. But he said this was not a quality of life he was on board with. Imagine that. So what he ended up doing was just getting loud about who I was while we were sitting there. So it was overheard. So that was the end of my job, and I was fired. And I just ran again. And I again... in the good graces of somebody that was, you know, good to me, would live at their place, contribute whatever I could to the household, and get by as I could. Well, he went to... So way back before, I think it was when I came back from Florida, and we just could not even talk to each other. He went to the police and said to the court and got me on probation on the grounds that I was incorrigible. So that really started me getting involved with the court systems. Then, of course, if you don't show up to your probation visits, then you get a warrant for your arrest. So jumping forward, after I lost my job there at this pizza place, that is what happened. There was a warrant for my arrest. I had spent some time in a group home at one point and ended up ran from that. And so I was there were warrants for me. So I had evaded the police for a long time, and it was during that time. Then I was probably, I think, 15 by then. They found me, and at this one house, and I evaded them once, but they were pretty sure it was me, so they came back and they kept trying to trick me, and they finally did. They got me. So they took me in. I spent a month in juvenile detention, and we went to court. The judge was willing to place me with a family member who would have me, if that my dad had to give consent. And so he would not consent to me living with my middle sister, who she says she would have taken me. We don't know, because that was never happened. My youngest sister, I'm sure, probably wouldn't have, but he wouldn't consent to any but the oldest. And she didn't want to take me in. So they decided to send me to girls' school, and so they did. And I spent a year in Indiana State Girls' School then, and I really had some good teachers academically in there, and who really caught me up in my school that I obviously missed a lot of it by then, and had very small classes, and I just remember my teachers. One of whom was just my English teacher, was so sweet, and she was a Jehovah's Witness. And I remember that so I felt like, on one hand, she couldn't be too free with anything she said, but on another hand, I know that she wanted to answer questions, and I had a few, and I remember thinking that her answers were very bizarre. So I kind of had a reputation as being a good girl, and, you know, relatively speaking, of course, this is I have a reputation for being a good girl among the bad girls. So the way over on this end of the spectrum, we have the girls in girls' school who are just bound and determined to be the outer limits, the bad faction. And they still picked on me. I'm getting picked on even in here. So, and a lot of it was, you know, I want to back up and say that through this, it still wasn't the worst. It got worse after this. But suicide was never, ever on the table to me. I knew people, had friends who it was definitely an option. And I never, ever, there just never was any option other than one foot in front of the other, when it was just too tough to keep going. The only thing that ever occurred to me was keep going. I believe, you know, that God really had his hand on me always, the whole time. That some of these things, I mean, you know, there were situations where, I mean, down there in Florida one time I was actually abducted. And I got away unscathed. I mean, it was, you know, I even in Indianapolis, just behind the mall, I had a guy just pull a gun on me and try to abduct me. And just things like that through all of this process. I was approached many times by predators, and I got away, you know, and I know that there's a lot of girls who never did. And nor did I ever think, like I said, that killing myself was ever an option. And I know that there's a lot of girls who thought that was very much a better scenario. So I got out of girls' school. I did my time. Actually, I got out in record time. A year was like pretty much the minimum in the program that I was in. And they put me on a bus and shipped me back to my dad. So I'm 16 and a half probably now. And my dad picks me up at the bus station. It was a long bus ride. And I'm thinking, okay, this is going to be a new chapter in my life. This is going to be way better. Okay. So my dad picks me up at the bus station, and he takes me home. And at that point, he was living in a 28-foot travel trailer with his mother, who he had liquidated her estate and moved back to Washington while I was in girls' school. And so my brother, my grandmother, and my father were all living in a 28-foot travel trailer, and I was to join them there. And I just remember just crying when we pulled up to there. I knew that that was the situation, but when I was confronted with it, it really hit me that this is no place to live. This is no life. And so I really wanted to be a good girl, and I tried to go to school and perform. You know, I cooked for them, and I cleaned the trailer, and went to school. And at this point in my life, he really treated me different than he did ever before. The harshness was gone. It was replaced by a complete blind eye. I don't see anything you do at all. So I started coming and going as I pleased, and I started partying and drinking with my friends, and I would do whatever I wanted, and he was like, he didn't even see it. And it didn't take very long before I was done with that then, and I dropped out of school when I was, I don't even think I was in my junior year yet. I think I was still in my sophomore year. I may have just finished my sophomore year and said, no, I'm done here. And was also done with living in that trailer with my family. So went back to what I knew, which was to, you know, I found somebody that I could babysit for them for live-in and whatnot. I could get by on that, and went back to that. And so that led to me being in a relationship with this guy for about a year. And it was during this time, and then that didn't work out. And I actually got a roommate position with the band that I was singing with at the time. So I was 18 then, and was rooming then with this band that I sang with. And that went for a while, and then I just circumstances, and I was working, cooking, and seemed to be leveling out and having what seemed like a bit of a normal life there. And ended up moving in with my brother, was a roommate with my brother again after that. I decided that I needed more direction, and I ended up just getting my GED, and I went to college. And not enough direction, ended up spending a long time in college changing directions. And I went like halfway through about three different programs. And I, in the midst of that, was really interrupted by... it was drugs and alcohol again, and got into a relationship that was extremely abusive, and was just so abusive and manipulative in such a way that caused me to really withdraw from, I had black eyes and wasn't able to to go to school or go anywhere, do anything, you know, and feel normal, like part of society. So it was a real mess. And that went on for about 2.5 years when the help that I sought, I really wanted out of this relationship, but it was extremely manipulative. And I really got caught in the vortex of that manipulation. And I knew that I wanted out of that. So I had heard that you could get money for if you were an alcoholic, that was a disease. So I went to the community alcohol center, and sure enough, she said, you sure can. So they actually really helped me a lot. They sent me to treatment. And I wanted that because I saw that as my ticket to get out of this relationship without being chased down, to actually get out, that I might get some help getting out of this relationship. So I did that, and lo and behold, come to find out, I actually was an addict. it was very helpful in every aspect. And I did get out of that relationship through that process. And I did have some people even on the other side. I went into a halfway house. And, of course, this person came after me. And I had people really stand with me and help me to stay out of it. So that really was a new beginning for me. I actually had some people help me train to get a job and find some a little more direction. So I ended up finishing my Associate of Arts degree, and then I went to beauty school, got a beauty certificate, ended up having my own business, and things were going well. And that is when I was a little too self-centered yet in my life, so that's about 25 years old, too self-centered to really make the most of having my own cosmetology business, because it's just so important to put that person the center of your world, and I wasn't there yet. I'm not exactly an extrovert anyway, I had a friend who did some hiring at the refineries when they would do shutdowns. They needed a lot of extra personnel, and a lot of times would hire women as fire watch and hull watches, and had a friend that was doing the hiring, so she got me on one summer. And boy, I really liked putting on my jeans and just going and not having to talk to people, and I made a lot of money. So I wanted to, I wanted to keep doing that instead of going back to doing hair. And that was when I met my husband, because he was out there working. And and in that industry, they, in the long run, they really don't like to have women on. Even if you know a craft, you usually have to, they will prefer to hire a man over you if they can. If you want to stay working in that industry, generally speaking, you really have to be on the coattails of a craftsman who will say, this is my helper, and they come with me. Sometimes, even if you're a guy, that's the case. If you're a helper, you need kind of craftsmen to be your advocate. So that ended up happening with Carl. So I have to give you a little bit of his background at this point. He was born and raised Seventh-day Adventist. He knew a lot about Scripture. And so just through our relationship, I remember him sometimes, although he was not practicing Seventh-day Adventism. He was not a Christian at all when I met him. He was, in fact, a practicing pagan. And he worshipped the Norse pantheon. And so there was bizarre stuff going on there. But he knew a lot about what the Word said. So with certain things would come up, and he would quote Scripture, and I can't even tell you what it was, but I remember being astounded when he spoke the word, or how it fit into the question that I had, how it answered the whatever question was on the table. I just remember being profoundly affected by some of the things he said that it said. And So we we're obviously not married. We're traveling the country working. Then I got pregnant with our first son, and I'm now trying to convince him that the best plan here is that he marries me, and you know, we do that. And I'm thinking back then, this is just like my mom. So finally, he agrees that to do that. So while I was pregnant with my second son, he met up with, on the job, a man that he had worked with many years prior who had just gotten out of prison, and he was now a Christian. And so they're working really as a team over one pipe. They're working together. And he's ministering to him daily. Well, at this point in my life, you know, the Lord had really been drawing me. And even as I was going through beauty school, and actually in high school back there in Skagit County, I had a couple of friends who really stuck and were friends, who were Christians. And I saw in their life something that I wanted. What I saw was safety. That's what I really wanted. Any place where I saw, wow, that looks like that could be safe, secure, like maybe they're, you know, they have some idea where they're going to be tomorrow. And that was instrumental, much more than I knew at the time. And so the Lord had really been drawing me. But when my first son was born, that was really the linchpin. I remember it was just like the bell tolled. And I remember that it was unacceptable for me to tell him what I'd been told, which was, you know, some people think this, some people think that, and you just kind of have to figure that out for yourself. And I remember that was like, no, I've got to figure this out. And I prayed. And I had no concept of really even who Jesus really was at that point. I knew who he was, sort of, but not really. But I just knew there was a God. And I think that always, since the day at the drainage ditch, I knew there was a God. And I knew that all of these times that I had survived these things and that I had this drive to just survive, it wasn't from me. I knew that wasn't from me. And so at this point, after my son, I pray. And I don't know for sure who I'm praying to, but I just know that there's a God, and just ask him, whoever you are, hear me, please hear me. And so at that point, after my son was born, I just prayed for the truth, that God would reveal the truth to me. So then meanwhile, you know, this John is ministering to my husband on this job. And so it was kind of for both of us, things really began to come together. By the time my husband's on that job with John, I am so hungry to give my heart to Jesus. But that I was, I knew at that point that if I did that and my husband wasn't there, it would tear us apart, and I wasn't willing to take that risk. And so so I just waited, and I kept asking him questions. And I asked him compelling questions, and he would give me an answer, what the Bible says about it. And, you know, this was just obviously, I mean, that was just causing something to bubble up, because you just can't, yeah, do that and not, you know, be convicted. So so it just really kind of came together like that. So it was just before our second child was born, there was something that happened. Our oldest son was 3, and he was so sick. My husband's traveling for work. He just comes home on the weekend, so it's probably a Friday, because he came home really late at night. And I said, you know, Cain has just been throwing up for 10 hours. And I was just worried. I was so worried. And he's gotten to the point where he's just pale and he's weak and he can't even hardly, you know, put his head over to throw up anymore. And so I'm wringing my hands, and he comes home, and he picks him up, and he prays for him. And he stopped throwing up. He didn't throw up again after he prayed. And then it was, I think actually that it was that night, but it was very shortly after, if not. There was a time he just sat up, bolt upright in bed. And I remember it started me. And I, what? And he said, the Nazarene is exactly who he said he was. And I remember just thinking, I said, it's about time. You know, because I was just so ready to go there. And so, you know, that was really the moment. And then I wanted to go to church. That was the next thing. And he was like, well, that's another thing, you know. That was another step that had to, and it didn't take too terribly long. I'd say it was maybe a month later, maybe 2 months later. And I started going to church, and John then started having those conversations. It's okay to go to church, Carl. And so we did, and I know that it was after that point that the Lord really got a hold of my husband. But for me, it was just like the doors had flown. I was so ready and so hungry that the doors had flown open for me. I just wanted to grab onto him with both hands. We were very fortunate to go into, actually the first church we went to was in Lewiston. It was a very short, like 2 months, and then we moved to Moses Lake. We went to a church there where we were just fed so intensively. Just some great people of God who discipled us. And we learned, you know, we learned and we grew and we walked, and then we had the rest of our kids there. So I would say that even still today, the Lord has been so gracious to take us to places where we could just really sink our teeth in and learn and grow. And this is such a wonderful, lovely church where he's brought us now. I'm so grateful. And so that question, why me? And I really feel like the Lord has answered that as much as it can be answered. In that it is not me, but it is about my kids and my progeny. Somehow I knew that when, you know, when we got saved and when we started this family, and then I knew that we were called to lay a foundation that had never been there before, so that something could come after us. And that's it. It's the covenantal, it's the generational covenant that is why me, so that my kids and their kids can start something new that wasn't there before. So anyway, thank you very much. I probably have gone way too long. And these are locked, or the phone is locked, so I can't shut it off.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate it.
So, ladies, why don't you turn and discuss and give your prayer requests, and we will finish about 11, all right?
Wow.
Julie went kind of long.